sports, entertainment, and Maine's best guest list. On The Pulse, AM 620 WZON, WZONThePulse.com, and the WZON app. This is Downtown with Rich Kimball.
Hi there, and a very good Sunday morning to you on this, the 13th day of the month of August. I'm Rich Kimball, here with Kerry Haskell, and it is indeed the best of Downtown, brought to you by Cross Insurance, where security meets strength. Our weekly look back at some of our favorite recent conversations. Guests of the program come your way, of course, on the G&M Family Market phone line. They're on the corner of Route 1A and Route 46 in Holden, and are open every day, 6 in the morning until 9 o'clock at night. Downtown also presented by Quirk Subaru. It's your car. Find it at Quirk. Well, what a great lineup we have for you this morning as we talk to some incredibly talented and creative people. Actor Karen Allen, talking about her lengthy career in films, including her debut directorial effort. Pulitzer Prize-winning author Elizabeth Strout discusses her brand new book. And we talk with veteran actors William Daniels and Bonnie Bartlett about their long career and a new book by Bill that chronicles his life and his time in the acting business. All that coming up as we take you through the next hour here on Downtown. Let's get things underway with an actress who made her debut nearly 40 years ago in Animal House, has gone on to roles in iconic movies like Raiders of the Lost Ark, Starman, Scrooged. A very long resume on stage as well for Karen Allen, who has also recently made her directorial debut, putting together a short film based on a short story by Carson McCullers entitled A Tree, A Rock, A Cloud. We talked about that recently with Karen Allen. After many years as an actor, and you've directed on stage before, but what prompted you to make your first film as a director?
You know, I was just sitting around with a producer I had worked with both in the theater as a director and as an actor, and he said to me, "Why haven't you directed a film?" And I said, "Well, you know, I feel like it's kind of an overwhelming thing. It's just a lot more complicated than directing a play from my perspective. You know, having been on film sets a lot of my life, I can't really fool myself into thinking that it's not an incredibly difficult task to direct a film." So he said, "Well, you know, if you were going to direct one, what would you be interested in doing?" And we began talking, and I said, "Well, I know for sure I would want to do a short film first, not a feature film." And he said, "Well, you know," we just started talking ideas, and this story that I have loved my whole life, I read it, I don't know, when I was 19 or 20 years old, and it always was just a Carson McCullers story that I thought was just a little gem of a story. And I mentioned it, and we started talking, and before I knew it, we were agreeing to work together to make this little film happen. So we did, and now it's on the film festival circuit, and I'm kind of jumping around from film festival to film festival, so...
And the story, A Tree, A Rock, A Cloud, is, among other things, a meditation on the nature of love.
It is. It is. It's a passing of wisdom from an older man to a young boy, and he tells him a story of his life, and it's mostly about ways in which he really has suffered and struggled and how he came to have a different way of looking at things that has changed everything about his life. And it's just a beautiful story. She wrote it when she was 25 years old. She was precociously a very interesting writer who wrote The Heart is a Lonely Hunter when she was 20. So, you know, it's kind of wonderful to bring a piece of her work onto film again, because there really hasn't been anything of hers put on film for about 25 years. So, and this is her 100th anniversary. She was born in 1917. So I've gotten not only to take it around to film festivals, but there are celebrations of her work that are happening all over the world this year, and I've been able to bring the film to those celebrations. I just came back from Rome, Italy, where the John Cabot University in Italy celebrated her work with an international kind of conference of people who are pretty much scholars of Carson McCullers.
Well, I'm a big fan of hers as well. Heart is a Lonely Hunter and Ballad of the Sad Cafe, two of my absolute favorites. What was the experience like of directing for the first time for film?
I absolutely loved it. I mean, it for me, there were a lot of challenges involved having never actually edited a film before. I was doing a lot of things for the first time. I'd never sat in a sound editing session or a sound design session or a color correction session, or a lot of the post-production aspects of it were, you know, brand new to me, because as an actor, you just never, or you don't participate in those aspects. So, you know, it was a steep learning curve, as they say. But I very much enjoyed every step of the process, and particularly I love working with the actors. So I used two actors who I have known for many, many years, Jeff DeMunn and James McMenamin. And James I had directed twice in the theater, and Jeff I've worked with on stage. So that was just a joy to be able to do something with them again. And then I have this lovely young man, 12-year-old boy, who is in the film, who's been winning awards for his performance. So that's pretty interesting.
We're talking with Karen Allen here on Downtown. Are more doors opening for women as directors?
They say there are. it's sort of seems to be something a lot of people talk about, although, you know, I think it's been being talked about for quite a number of years. And, you know, I just recently saw a film called The 4%, which is about, you know, how only 4% of films or television or any kind of programs are directed by women. So I don't know, based on our 51% population, I don't know if 4% is really what one could consider a good number. But I think, you know, there are a lot of, I'm saying this sort of in jest, but there are a lot of very positive things happening for women in film, not just as directors, but in all kinds of areas where traditionally you very rarely saw a female cinematographer, or you very rarely saw a female production designer, even for that matter, and on and on and on. So I think there are more jobs opening up. It's just, you know, I think it's because it's such a absolutely consuming job when you're doing it. It's very difficult for women who have any other things going on in their life, say being a mother or something. You know, it's a very, very difficult task to be working, to be directing a film and trying to do anything else in your life at all.
You made your debut, of course, in 1978 in Animal House, and it was very sad to hear recently of the passing of Stephen Furst.
I know. He was just one of the all-time lovely human beings, and we were all very, very sad that he left us. But he had health issues for a long time, and while it was a complete surprise, I also, you know, knew that he was struggling with all kinds of issues, but he was just the most lovely person.
I can only imagine, what were the experiences like of being with that cast? Because you had some interesting individuals on that set.
Yes, we did. I had, you know, it was my first film, and it was the first film of a lot of the other actors that were in it, which made it an awful lot of fun because, you know, we were all in the same boat, just kind of, you know, going by the seat of our pants. And for John Landis, too, who was the director, he had done a couple of, you know, very short, they were feature films, but they were very, very indie kinds of films. So this was a first-time experience for him, really having any kind of real budget and having a studio behind a film, and so, you know, it was, we had an awful lot of fun doing it. It was a great spirit on the set, and a lot of really, really talented young actors.
You've been in so many iconic films through the years, but the film that we featured in the opening to the segment here is one that, I don't think it's mentioned as much. Starman with Jeff Bridges, I thought was just such a wonderful movie.
I love that film, and I mean, it actually lives on. It's one of the films I think that people talk to me about the most. I think when it came out, it was up against a couple of other really, you know, heralded sci-fi films. I think that's when literally within weeks of each other, 2010 came out, and also Dune, I think, both came out. So I think it, at the time, it didn't do as well in the theaters as maybe, you know, we all hoped that it would, although I think it did fairly well. But you know, I think it lives on in whatever ways films live on, you know, by being shown on television or you know, on Netflix and things like that.
You also were in a wonderful movie with Sissy Spacek that was filmed up here in Maine, In the Bedroom. Did you come to Maine for that?
I did. I had met with the director, you know, at one point, and he wasn't even sure. What I think there was a moment where it looked like Sissy Spacek was not going to be able to do the film, and he was meeting with me on the chance that maybe I could step in if she couldn't do it. And I loved the film as when I read it, I loved the script so much that I just said to him, well, look, you know, if it turns out Sissy can do it, and, you know, if there's another role in this that you would like me to do, I would just love to be in the film. I think it's a wonderful script. And we, you know, in the end, Sissy did do it, and we settled on me playing this attorney. And I just came up there, I think, for a day. I was there for, you know, I arrived, I shot for a day, and went home the next day. So as things went, yeah.
Well, you're an adopted New Englander for some time. Your home in the Berkshires has been, I would think, just a wonderful place for you to be to indulge all of your arts. You've got your shop, Karen Allen Fiber Arts. You work a lot in the theater community and the creative community there in Great Barrington.
Yes, it's a pretty fantastic area to live in. You know, I'm trying to keep that a secret, so it's as small a community as it is. But no, it's beautiful. We have Tanglewood, we have Jacob's Pillow, we have the theaters, we have, you know, I'm on the board of the Berkshire International Film Festival, which has just grown and become this really extraordinary event that kind of launches the season. And, you know, we have little ski mountains, and it's just, you know, it's quite a beautiful place to live. And I raised my son here, which was really, in a way, why I ended up moving here was to put him in school here. So and he still lives in the Berkshires. He was born in New York, and he grew up somewhat in New York City, and I thought for sure he would be a New York City boy, but as it turns out, he likes living in the Berkshires.
Speaking of your son, though, I get this from the unimpeachable source of Wikipedia, but is it true that he was a winner on Chopped?
Yes, just recently. In about 6 months ago, he won Chopped. Yeah.
That's wonderful.
Yeah. He is quite an exceptional young chef, and he started out very, very young, and he's 26 now, but he's been cooking professionally, gosh, since he was 14.
Well, Karen, I will tell you that the 19-year-old Rich Kimball here would have been absolutely giddy at the prospect of talking with Katie from Animal House. And all these years later, this version of Rich is pretty excited, too. It's been a real treat to talk with you this afternoon.
Oh, thanks. Thanks so much.
We wish you much success with A Tree, A Rock, A Cloud, and all your future endeavors.
Thank you so much.
That's actress Karen Allen here on Downtown talking about her directorial debut that's making the festival circuit right now, A Tree, A Rock, A Cloud. When we come back on Downtown, we'll talk with Elizabeth Strout about her brand new book, and it's another great one entitled Anything Is Possible. You're listening to The Pulse, AM 620 WZON.
Worried about buying a pre-owned vehicle? Experience the pre-owned difference with Quirk Auto Group. Every pre-owned vehicle from Quirk comes with a Carfax Vehicle History Report, a Quirk-certified pre-owned inspection, a 3-month, 3,000-mile limited warranty, and state inspections for the life of the vehicle. That's the Quirk pre-owned difference. Experience it for yourself at more than 10 statewide locations. It's your car. Find it at Quirk, quirkauto.com. Wholesale vehicles excluded from the 3-month, 3,000-mile limited warranty and main state inspections.
Since its founding in 1954, Cross Insurance has grown from a small family-owned agency that started in Bangor, Maine, into one of the largest super-regional insurance agencies in New England. With a network of offices throughout New England, Cross Insurance works with top carriers to provide maximum value to you, your family, and your business. We are proud to be the official insurance broker of the New England Patriots and would welcome the chance to provide security for your team. For more information, visit crossinsurance.com. Cross Insurance, where security meets strength.
Dunnett Appliance and Mattress has been family-owned and operated since 1948, selling all major brands of appliances. Stop in at 63 Washington Street, Penobscot Plaza, Bangor, and find out about the Dunnett's Advantage. At Dunnett's, they'll price match any local competitor, and they also offer special financing options. Of course, Dunnett's services what they sell with their own parts and service department, and they offer free delivery to most areas. Come on into Dunnett's, 63 Washington Street in Bangor, and see the difference you get with a local family-owned and operated business. Dunnett's has done it again.
Green Acres Kennel Shop is your pet's home away from home. In fact, Green Acres has been voted the best kennel in the Bangor region every year since 2002 and one of the top 15 kennels in New England in 2016. With award-winning and knowledgeable staff and owners that live on site, you can be confident your pet is in good hands. Not only does Green Acres provide top-notch boarding for your dogs and cats, but they have also been voted the Bangor area's best pet groomer, dog trainer, and best pet store for the past several years. Located conveniently at 1653 Union Street in Bangor, make Green Acres Kennel your pet's home away from home. Visit them online today at greenacreskennel.com for more information or call them at 945-6841. Don't forget to ask about their rewards and frequent buyer programs.
We love Green Acres Kennel Shop, a home away from home.
Biking season is here, and the only way to be sure that you're road or trail ready is to bring your bike to Slipping Gears Cycling, Bangor's only full-time cycling sales and service experts at 753 Stillwater Avenue in Bangor before prime riding season slips away. Slipping Gears Cycling, 753 Stillwater Avenue in Bangor, Bangor's best full-service bike shop. Outstanding service, huge stock. Like them on Facebook for updates, shop in person and online at slippinggears.com.
Hey girl, what you doing down there? Dancing alone every night while I live right above you.
Back here on Downtown, another retro weekend. Casey Kasem, American Top 40, the 80s coming up after us. Before we get there, though, more great conversations. William Daniels, Bonnie Bartlett coming up in a little bit. But right now, Pulitzer Prize-winning author Elizabeth Strout, who's created so many memorable characters and works through the years, from Olive Kittredge to My Name is Lucy Barton, and her latest, Anything is Possible. She visited with Bruce Pratt, Carrie and I in studio the other day to talk about her newest work. Thank you again for making me cry like a baby in the middle of reading a book.
Oh, you're so welcome.
I was doing pretty well, a little bit at times, and then I got to the story at the end with Abel, and I was gone.
I'm glad to hear that, Abel Blaine. Yes.
Hi, Liz. This is Bruce. One of the things that I think was so wonderful about this book, you've clearly been able to do something that the rest of us can't do on a regular basis, and that is write a book that is has these encapsulated stories, but feels when it's done like I've seen a motion picture. That each one of the each story seems like a great scene. Now I know you don't always do things in order. That you don't always
right.
How much of this book was written out of order, if you will?
The whole thing was written out of order. I just the first story I think was the last one I finished.
That gives you some indication right there. And, you know, I wrote many scenes of the stories at the same time. So I would, you know, write a piece of Abel Blaine's story, and then I would jump back and think, okay, let's see what the sister's up to, you know. So I don't write anything from beginning to end, including a story.
One of the things that I was thinking about when I was reading this was how back in 67, Bart said that, you know, we were writing in the age of exhaustion. And it seems to me that sometimes we're writing these days in the age of ADD. And I found this is a book I thought, boy, to my friends who say they don't read novels, I wanted to give them this and say, read each story a little bit at a time, and you'll see how a narrative works. Are you finding that this is a really good way to write?
You know, that's an interesting observation about, you know, this writing in age of ADD. And I think that I'm not conscious of that as I write. I'm only writing the way I need to write at the time that I'm writing whatever it is I'm writing. But I do think that this lends itself to, you know, people who can't concentrate, you know, for a full load at a time, that I do see things in terms of scenes. And each of these pieces or stories or whatever one wants to call them is, you know, a scene in and of itself. And so it's interesting that you say that you saw it as, you know, almost like a movie.
I'm so struck by this, and maybe it's because I'm a fairly recent dad, but so many of these characters struggle with overcoming either who they were as children or who other people thought they were.
Yeah, right. Well, you know, I have always been interested in, well, first of all, I'm just interested in people, endlessly interested in people. And then I've also always been interested in the whole nature versus nurture thing, because I think that we are born a self. And then I think that, you know, the forces of nature come at us and nurture, you know, or not being nurtured. So that combination is always one that's complex and interesting to me as a writer. So, you know, yes, these are people who have a variety of backgrounds, and their ability to overcome them or not overcome them is probably already in place.
And even Lucy, and it was so wonderful for her to come back and to see where she is in her life. But even though she's been able to physically escape that difficult childhood, when she goes back home, it's always there rearing its head.
It's too much for her. That's right. Yeah. Yeah. And her siblings are living it.
You've created in Amgash your own world and done it with, I think, just stunning precision. I feel like I've been to the town, even though I haven't. And I was thinking, I was thinking about the way that sometimes as writers, we step outside the geography we know best and try and create another place. And Amgash is obviously very different from the Maine in which so many of your other pieces are set.
Right.
And I know you went out there, but do you, when you're writing in New York, do you see the place? Have you got like a physical thing you can see?
Yes, I very much do. And we did make a number of trips out there. And, you know, Amgash is a fictional town. I never saw, you know, a town exactly like Amgash. But I saw bits and pieces that very much stay in my mind. And I do see it very clearly when I'm writing it. So it was important for me to, you know, to make those trips.
We're talking with Elizabeth Stroud on Downtown. Her latest book is entitled Anything Is Possible. Do writers play favorites with characters? I want so badly for things to work out well, especially for Patty and for Charlie.
Yeah. Oh, that's so interesting. You know, I love them. I really love that, those two people, and especially Charlie McCauley. He just, I don't know what it is about him, but he really had my heart, Charlie. I mean, they all do. They really all do. But for some reason, Charlie McCauley and then Patty, you know, I had to give them a shot.
Well, and they're all such, at their core, even, you know, even Lucy's sister, who when they first reconnect is certainly a bit standoffish, to say the least. But all of these people, there's just a core of decency and humanity.
I think so. I think that that's absolutely true. And you know, the title Anything Is Possible really means, you know, not that, you know, I'm going to be Queen of England or that the earth is going to be flat or anything like that, but it's possible for people of very different lives and backgrounds to have these moments of grace. And that's what I think happens in these stories, that they, that, you know, each story has its moment of grace that comes to somebody who's probably least expecting it. And Lucy's sister, she is a fundamentally decent person. She really is. And that woman that, you know, knows her in the nursing home that where she works recognizes that, the patient in the nursing home, you know, so.
And those, it would seem from the book, those are the victories in life. It's not about
exactly.
the wealth. It's not about the acclaim. It's those indeed, those moments of grace, those moments
right.
when the world opens up and suddenly makes sense to you.
That's right. That's exactly right. And I think that's what was happening in these stories.
These characters are all so fully realized and so fully realized so quickly. Do you ever sit down and have conversations with them? I know this happens to me when I'm writing. I start talking to one of my characters. Do you find yourself in conversation with these people?
You know, that's a good question. I don't know that I actually talk to them, but I'm so connected to them as I'm writing that I might as well be in conversation with them, because, you know, they're very, very real to me as I write them.
And how hard is
I have to remind myself that they're not real, actually.
How hard is it to let go of them when the project comes to an end?
Yeah, I never quite do let go of them. I mean, they're gone from my desk and they're out in the world, and I, you know, wish the best for them because they continue to feel very real to me.
I was wondering about that a little bit. I'm glad Rich asked that question. I once asked the author Brad Barkley about a story my students had read, and they said, I really want to know what happens to these people next. And Brad said, no, I'm done with them. that story's over. And then he said, but, well, I guess this might happen. And I wondered if part of that was the process of moving from Lucy Barton to this book. Was it that there were just things left undone, or was it that?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to.
No. That was basically my point. Yeah.
Right. No, I started to write these stories at the same time that I was writing My Name is Lucy Barton. And it's because when Lucy and her mother are talking in the hospital about people from Lucy's past, I became interested, and I thought, well, what happened to those pretty nicely girls? And so I would jot down a scene, you know, of one of the nicely girls and what they were up to at the moment. And then I would think, what happened to Mississippi Mary? Let's go find out. So, you know, I wasn't done with these people. And that's, you know, where the book came from.
Liz, I'm always fascinated about the discipline of writers, and Bruce and I have talked about this a lot here on the program. Everybody has a method that works for them. Do you allot time each day to sit down and write? What's your means of operation out there?
You know, I pretty much try to write first thing in the morning for, you know, maybe 4 or 5 hours. But I'm not writing that whole time. That would not be true, but I'm sitting thinking about them. And then, you know, so I try and work, you know, 5 days a week. It's my job, and that's what I try and do. And then I'll go back to it sometimes, you know, later in the afternoon, take a peek at it. But that's always risky because, you know, if I didn't work that well, then I realize in the afternoon, you know, I'm going to have a bad evening. But that's what I try and do is the mornings. And I'll put lunch off as long as I can.
One of the one of the other things I was wondering about to follow up on that Rich said is that when you're writing these stories, I tell people all the time that poets have drawers full of unfinished poems because some mm-hmm. things don't get finished. When you're mm-hmm. writing the scenes and the sketches and stuff, how do you keep them organized in your mind? I would think that would be really difficult. I find that very difficult to do.
Right, and I honestly don't know the answer to that, but somehow there is a part of my mind that seems to know what I'm doing even when I don't consciously know what I'm doing. So as long as I keep focusing on scenes that seem to really have a heartbeat to them, then I feel like that's a good day's work. If I can produce, you know, a scene or two that has the real thing in it, then they will eventually connect. And I do, on some level, understand, okay, this will be connected to Abel Blaine, and we're going to come back and see Dottie here, you know. So So I'm not, but I'm honestly not sure how I do that. That's the honest answer.
Do you come up with your characters internally or externally? Do you see people in the world and see elements of their personality and think that would be an interesting character trait to explore? How does that work for you?
You know, that's, I do both. I might see somebody, you know, on the street and just have them physically stay with me. And it might take me a couple of years even before I use their body, you know, as a reference point, and then infuse them with a character. Other people come to me internally, and I will just sort of feel like, you know, like Patty Nicely, for example, she just sort of arrived from my inside, and Charlie McCauley as well. And so it can happen both ways.
Do you find that where you are physically changes the way you write in any way?
You know, that's an interesting question, and I don't think so. I think that I've always, from a very young age, you know, I've been writing for so many years, that I think I can write pretty much anywhere, actually. I know I can. So I just can do that.
Yeah, I'm glad you said that, because you hear so many writers who say all the time, well, I need to get back to my office and my place to write and this and that. And I think, well, why? Because you're thinking about other places all the time. Why couldn't you write something? I mean, I understand why you might not write.
Exactly.
I was curious about that, because you have both a Maine home and a New York home, and you couldn't be more different in some ways in terms of location, but it always seems your writing is so seamlessly good that I just had to ask that question. I just wanted to know how to do it.
No, that's a good question, and I've thought about it. I mean, I can honestly can write in a hotel room, and I can write, you know, I used to write scenes on the subway. If they came to me, I'd write them down. So, you know, I think I've learned from very early on that, you know, I can write anywhere.
Well, the turnaround at least seemed to me so quick between Lucy Barton and Anything Is Possible.
Right.
What are you working on right now? Can you tell us?
Oh, I'd love to, but I can't, because the reason I can't is that, you know, the writing for me has to have a furtiveness to it as I'm working on it. You know, I have to feel secretive about it somehow, and it has to be a private thing, because the pressure has to build. And it's like, if I tell somebody, then it releases the pressure. So, but I would love to tell you.
But then you'd have to kill us, and I understand completely.
Yeah.
Well, Liz, it's just a remarkable book filled with such unforgettable characters.
Thank you very, very much. I'm so glad to hear that.
Loved every page of it, and it's such a delight for us to get to talk with you again.
Oh, yeah, it's been wonderful to talk to you as well. Thank you so much.
That's Elizabeth Strout talking about her brand new book, and it is a terrific one, entitled Anything Is Possible. When we come back, a couple of Emmy Award-winning actors and folks who've been married for 66 years and still going pretty well, thank you much. William Daniels, Bonnie Bartlett, next on The Best of Downtown.
When it comes to your health, early detection is the best protection. That's why the St. Joseph Regional Breast Care Center provides 3D mammography to offer better answers and greater peace of mind, identifying problem areas that a standard mammogram might miss. It provides precise images for all women, including those with dense breast tissue. Call 907-1682 to schedule your 3D mammogram at the St. Joseph Regional Breast Care Center. 3D, providing peace of mind for you, your family, and your loved ones.
Since its founding in 1954, Cross Insurance has grown from a small family-owned agency that started in Bangor, Maine, into one of the largest super-regional insurance agencies in New England. With a network of offices throughout New England, Cross Insurance works with top carriers to provide maximum value to you, your family, and your business. We are proud to be the official insurance broker of the New England Patriots and would welcome the chance to provide security for your team. For more information, visit crossinsurance.com. Cross Insurance, where security meets strength.
Whatever you're looking for, G&M Family Market has got what you need. They're on the corner of Route 1A and Route 46 in Holden. They have fresh produce delivered daily, a great selection of meats and seafood, beer and wine, a Dunkin' Donuts right there, and an Amato's as well. And if there's something you can't find, just ask, and they'll make every effort to get it for you next time. It's G&M Family Market, Route 1A, Route 46 in Holden. They're open every day from 6 in the morning until 9 p.m.
There's only one way Hartley's Chrysler Dodge Jeep Ram in Newport does business. The right way. Owned and operated for over 60 years by the Hartley family, Hartley's offers the same or even better prices and discounts on vehicles as those offered at mega dealerships. And along with that comes their renowned small dealer service and exceptional attitude toward you, their customers. Hartley's values your business and your trust. You're never pushed, never pressured. No one will chase you around the lot, but no one will ignore you either. Hartley's wants you to feel comfortable at their dealership. So feel free to look around, and Hartley's professional sales staff will always be there when you need help. You'll like the place, you'll like the people, and you'll like the way they do business. The right way. The folks at Hartley's wouldn't do it any other way. Always remember, if you're out there looking around, the best deals aren't in the city, they're in the country. Hartley's Country, at the Triangle in Newport. You'll always be treated the right way at Hartley's.
We're back. It's the best of downtown for your Sunday morning. Rich Kimble, Terry Haskell here with you. Red Sox baseball later today. Terry, I hope you're feeling good this Sunday morning, this day.
I will assume I am.
Yeah, because next Sunday, not so much. After we play a little wiffle ball, Wayne's Wiffle for a Wish, the annual charity wiffle ball tournament coming up next Saturday, and the downtown team attempting to retain its championship stranglehold, all to benefit the Make-A-Wish Foundation. You'll be a little stiff and sore next Sunday, I'm just saying.
Well, I'll do my best to contribute.
You bring the cooler. You do that, you have helped us out tremendously.
I have one on wheels.
There you go, even better. So you might be MVP already, even without taking one swing. Hey, up next here on the Best of Downtown, we had so much fun last week as we talked to a couple of veteran actors. They're really sweet and wonderful people. William Daniels and Bonnie Bartlett, they won Emmy Awards for their work together on St. Elsewhere. Bonnie's appeared on the old soap opera Love of Life back in the 50s and 60s. Both have been big stars on Broadway. Bill Daniels played the father of Dustin Hoffman in The Graduate. Both of them appeared as well in Boy Meets World and the Disney sequel Girl Meets World. And Bonnie was in the cast last season of the hit series Better Call Saul. Our conversation with William Daniels and Bonnie Bartlett. It certainly seems like the process of writing this book about your life has caused you to certainly reevaluate some things, starting with the experiences you had in your childhood.
Yes, that's true. I thought I should start there because that's when my sister and I started. My sister and I started performing. Very young.
Well, and it seems that you discovered as well that the ambivalence that you seem to have at times about acting was not that at all, but perhaps a defense mechanism?
Yes, that's possible, yes, because I didn't know exactly. We were put into the business really early, but I thought I wanted to do something other than that. But I had a stage mother who had ambitions for both me and my sisters in show business. And so we all went along with that.
Well, and that led you to be on Broadway at a very early age in Life with Father. And in that opportunity that you had in that show, you also met someone that became a real role model for you. Can you talk about the impact that Howard Lindsay had on you?
Yes. I saw him getting ready to return to the role of life, of father in Life with Father, after having been out for, I don't know, six months or a year. He and Miss Dickney were coming back into the play, so they were doing a brush-up rehearsing, and I got a chance to be with them as I was going from assistant stage manager into the second oldest child. There were four children. And so I had an opportunity to work with him, breaking into the role, which was very helpful. And in the meantime, me observing his deportment off stage as well as on, it became a role model for me.
Because Bill was just a kid from Brooklyn.
Yeah.
Very Brooklynese dad.
Yeah, right. And so, I think I wrote in the book that I asked advice of him, and he directed me in the right direction.
Following some time in the military, you found your way to Northwestern University, and that was an interesting path. Can you tell the story of trying to make sure that you had the proper grades and the qualifications to enter college?
Yes. Didn't I write that in the book?
Yes, Seth, he wants you to go over that.
Oh, I see. Mr. Lodge, his name was, and he had an apartment on about 54th Street in Manhattan. And, you know, he had a small group of young performers who were performing, at the time. And I was performing at the time, but I went there, and it was just kind of a cover for the law, really, to have some education. So I went, and I'd check in, and then I'd say, excuse me, I have an appointment, and then I'd go down to Nestle's or someplace and have coffee and read my New York Times. So I wasn't taking that education very seriously. And I probably missed out on important things I should have learned, but I'm not sure I would have learned them there, because the whole place was just the cover for the law, really. And what was it, Bonnie? I was going to Northwestern, right?
you had applied there.
To Northwestern.
To Northwestern, and they called Mr. Lodge.
Yes, they called Mr. Lodge about my grades, and... he hadn't kept any record of that, and he called me and he said, "Well, Bill, we had a fire." He made up this whole story. Your grades were, we lost all of that information on all the students. And I said, "That's terrible, Mr. Love." She said, "Do you remember any of your grades?" Yeah, I think I do. What do you need? So we went down a whole list of things. Half of them I never had, and I gave myself, I didn't want to get too greedy, but, 90 to 92 right in there, which I probably never earned. But he wrote it all down and sent it back to the High School of Music and Art, at Northwestern, and I got to Northwestern that way. I was a fraud, actually, and... there I met a very interesting girl who sits across the way from me right now, who helped me to learn how to study, how to underline important things that when you review, you don't have to review the whole thing. It's just the things you underlined, which were important to ready yourself for an exam. So she really got me through the whole thing in 3.5 years, because she was very anxious to get to New York. That was Bonnie, and so I went along, and we went to New York together.
Yeah, even though, Bonnie, if I remember correctly from the book, when he first asked you out for coffee, you said no because he wasn't tall enough.
I said, "You're too short."
Yeah, she said, you're too short. And I said, "Oh, come on, have some coffee." She said, "Okay." And
I really meant was that I was too tall for him. In other words, I wasn't being critical of him being too short, but I just thought it was not appropriate because I was as tall as he was, and I all the men in my family were 6 feet. I thought I should be with somebody 6 feet tall.
Well, 60,
was not that.
66 years now, do you think it will work out?
I could have tried elevated shoes, but I don't know if they made them that high.
No.
Yeah.
Well,
so we never expected anything. We were not that romantic. At least I wasn't. We never expected to be together this long. No way.
We are talking with William Daniels and Bonnie Bartlett here on Downtown. In New York, you had a chance, Bonnie, to study with the legendary Lee Strasberg, and Bill just... kind of hung around and observed early on. Is that right?
That's right. He didn't really believe in acting teachers that much, and nor did my father, who had been an actor. And I didn't know who Lee Strasberg was, but as soon as I went into his class, I thought, "Oh my God, this is wonderful! I got to learn how to do this," because I had always just acted, just acted as I felt and imitated and acted, and he teaches behavior, and so when you learn to behave on stage, it's all the world is different.
And I just followed her to the class just to keep tabs on her because, you know, she was going off and rehearsing with some guy in his apartment. I didn't know what was going on, so I had I didn't believe you learned acting. I believe that you learn it on the boards, as they used to say. Acting on the boards, meaning, you know, actual theater. And I soon learned differently because Lee Strasberg stripped me of that nonsense, and he was very instrumental in both our lives.
There's an interesting story in the book, and a sad one, too, about you observing a conversation with Marilyn Monroe at one of the parties when folks were talking with you, Bonnie. What was the comment that Marilyn made?
She stood in back of me as I was talking to a very kind of intellectual director, young, you know, and he was explaining how he would do a certain production, and I was standing talking to him, very serious, and she came and stood in back of me. She did trust me, and we got along. Anyway, and she stood in back of me. She said, "I just want to feel what it's like to be talked to like an intelligent person."
Wow.
That was sad.
Bill, let's talk about Zoo Story, Edward Albee's first hit, a one-act play that became a sensation. What did that opportunity do for your career?
That opportunity? Well, it led to other things, actually. I got a couple of awards, and it put me on a map in New York. Everybody came to see it. I mean, just about everybody. And it was Edward's first play, and it was a huge hit. And so I, things led from that. For instance, A Thousand Clowns. Herb Gardner saw the Zoo Story, and he wrote A Thousand Clowns and wrote a part in it that he wanted me to do. And so one thing led to another thing, and A Thousand Clowns led to other things. And, the Zoo Story really got me started in New York.
The first Broadway musical I ever had the pleasure of seeing was 1776, a remarkable production. And not only in that role, but in others, the Addams Family has been very good to you, Bill.
Oh, I have a corner on the Addams. you saw 1776 with me in it?
I did.
Oh, good. Anyway, that was a wonderful role for me, probably the largest role I ever had, and I played it for a long time, probably too long. But it was a highlight in my career when I think about it, and John Addams became kind of second nature to me. I had a certain personality traits that I could use in that, and they translated pretty well into John Addams.
I was...
Down, John.
Yes. Noxious and dislike.
I was surprised to learn in the book the length of the contract that you signed to play John Addams, something that would be unheard of today.
Oh, unheard of, yes, absolutely. And that's a good thing, too, because these actors shouldn't stay in something that long. I only did because they doubled my salary for the second year, so I stayed in it too long, but I made some money.
Then Hollywood beckoned, and you made a movie that's become one of the most important movies and acclaimed movies of all time, The Graduate. Mike Nichols, a hot director at the time, coming off Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, but originally Mike Nichols didn't want you to play the part of Benjamin's dad.
He didn't?
Yeah.
Well, that's not true.
No, that's not true. What happened, he wanted me in the picture.
Right, but
he wanted
didn't...
all these actors from New York in the picture. They're all from New York, including Dustin. But the producer said, "Bill, you know, Dustin's playing this role, and, you're too young to play his father."
Mm.
There was about a 9 or 10 year difference between us, Dustin and myself. And Mike Nichols said, "No, that doesn't matter." And he dismissed that.
But it is true that he originally offered you the part of the clerk.
Oh, yeah.
And you said, that's not big enough.
He offered me that, and I turned it down, and he called me, and he said, why did you? I said, it's too small, Mike. And he said, it's got two lefts. I said, I know that. But, so he said, well, how about one of the fathers? Well, that's a whole different thing, you know. I said, well, let me go back and look at it. And I did, and it was a substantial part. And so that's the way I worked for Mike in that.
Did you have any idea?
A great guy.
While making that movie, did any of you have an idea? Could you have known how important this film would be, really, in the history of cinema?
Oh, yeah. No, nobody knows anything like that. In any of the, any of the theatrical endeavors, I've been involved in them as an assistant director to Jerome Robbins. Nobody knows what you've got until you put it in front of an audience, really. Some have a more of a talent and instinct for something that might work successfully. But honestly, you can't tell what you've got until you go in front of an audience.
That meant that Hollywood beckoned, and it meant a move. And Bonnie, that wasn't a move you were excited about making.
No, I loved New York, and I didn't want to leave. And he had all these offers, and I thought, this is crazy to leave now, Bill, because now you finally, John Adams, you're the star of the show. And now you've been offered, Bob Fosse's offered you something, somebody else's. How can you possibly leave now? He said, I don't want to work in the theater anymore. I want to go out to California and live a more normal life.
Eight a week, I did an awful lot of that. And it's,
And it was great. It turned out great. But yeah. I was very much opposed. I wanted my boys to go to school in New York. And actually, it worked out great coming here. So I was totally wrong about that.
Well, let's talk about the
working one thing after another with these agents that I was with, and introduced her to them, and they sent her out, and she got everything they ever sent her out on.
Well, yes,
not only that, it was good for the family because Bill was here. He was here all the time.
Right, even during St. Elsewhere, you were able to keep relatively normal hours.
Absolutely. Absolutely, because we were right neck down from the studio, it was wonderful. So we've always been able to be close with our kids, and that's really important.
Let's talk about St. Elsewhere, a wonderful series. The roles of Mark and Ellen Craig brought you such acclaim, becoming only the second couple ever to win Emmy Awards for the same role, for the same show on the same night. And that was an incredible feat.
Yeah, that's right. I think...
That was very exciting, I must say. That was very exciting. A wonderful show. We were so proud of that show.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Although, Bill, when you won that first Emmy Award, you almost missed getting the Emmy because the limo broke down. Is that right?
Yeah, the limo broke down, and... I was watching McEnroe play tennis, and I had to get into a monkey suit and get into a limo. And we get up on the 101 here, and the limo breaks down, and I got out of the car and walked home and turned on the McEnroe match. And Bonnie came back in another limo, which they sent out for her. And here I was, and I had taken off the monkey suit and everything in my shorts, watching John McEnroe. I was a great fan of his, and to play tennis. And she said, what are you doing? And I said, well, I'm watching John. And she said, get back in your clothes. I said, Bonnie. She said, get back in your clothes. And I had my hair done. I bought a special dress. And I said, okay. So I got back in the monkey suit. We got in the car. And by now we're late. The whole thing has started. So we creep in there, go down the aisle, and find our place that we're supposed to sit. Excuse me, dear. And I go, bump a knees down to where we're supposed to sit. And just as I sit, they said, William Daniels. And I thought, oh, my God, I won this thing. And I said, excuse me. And I walked down the aisle, and I thought, what the hell am I going to say? I can't think of what I'm going to say. Well, how about thank you? Maybe that'll do. So that's the way it happened. And we almost missed the damn thing.
Let's talk about Boy Meets World.
Bill, people think Bill is elegant. He's not elegant. he talks about monkey suits, and he talks about, you know. We turned down so many invitations, it's terrible, but that's it's okay with me, too. But it's he's just not part of that society of what am I called, red carpet people? He can't stand it. So
let's talk about Boy Meets World, and you got to play husband and wife yet again. And when I'm not on the radio, I'm a high school teacher, and so thank you for your insistence, Bill, on not playing Mr. Feeney strictly as a comedic character.
Yes, yes, it was important to me not to make fun of teachers, and he respected that, and so he wrote a decent part with respect, and it turned out very well, actually. And
it's kind of amazing, really.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it's a wonderful role model. And you know something? I think one of the reasons maybe that all of a sudden there's been a kind of resurgence in popularity could be that, you know, we need role models now, particularly with a president who is such a terrible role model. And so I think it's kind of strangely nice that people respected Mr. Feeney so much and love Mr. Feeney and feel that he's taught them a lot, and it's maybe turned people to respecting teachers a little more.
We got a lot of mail that expressed what she's saying about the part.
Bill, are you surprised, too, with the affection that people continue to feel for your voice role as a Kit in Knight Rider?
And, you know, that was one of the first of those shows where there's a car that speaks. I thought that was insane. And the producer I had worked with doing a movie of the week, and he said to me, oh, you've read this. I don't need to go into this. Anyway, I thought, I went over there to read it so he could sent it to New York, and I looked at it because I had no idea what it was, and then I thought, this is a car? And he said, yeah. I said, and it talks. He said, yeah. I said, okay, you know, and I thought, this is ridiculous. And 3 weeks later, he calls and said, you know, we sold it. Would you do it? I said, well, you know, I'm doing St. Elsewhere. He said, we know that. We'll work around it. So my agent said, Bill, you can't turn that down. It's ridiculous.
And it's gone on and on and on and on every year.
Yes, right.
Huge fans.
I was just reading something about it where David Hasselhoff, who worked so hard on the lead role, and, you know, he said, I've never met him when I did it. You know, my voice, I just went to a recording studio at Universal and put it down. And he said, how long does it take you? This was David. How long does it take you to do this? I said, oh, 45, 50 minutes. He said, oh, God damn it. He said, I'm out there and sweating and, you know, all of that. It was kind of fun. I only met him during the Christmas party.
You both continue to work, Bonnie. It was a delight to see you on Better Call Saul.
Oh, yes. That turned out to be, you know, a really nice experience. I really didn't half wanted to do it, but my agent said, oh, this is a big show, you got to go do it. And so, working with Bob Odenkirk, I really admire him. I really think he's terrific. And I think the show, it took me a while to get used to the show, because I hadn't watched the other show. I hadn't watched
Breaking Bad.
Mm. So it took me a while to get used to the way it's done. And now I love it. Now I love it. But it was an adjustment because they do it very slowly and they deliberately don't go for any kind of obvious comedy.
So
very subtle.
Before we let you go, I'd like to ask you both this at a time, and you mentioned the situation in Washington, at a time when funding for the arts is imperiled in a lot of ways. Why is it important for us to continue to support the arts, and especially the arts in our schools?
I think that...
To support the arts? Well,
because the arts is the part of the culture that...
That's right.
...that keeps us honest. It keeps us honest. It keeps us aware of what's going on. It's very, very important. And hopefully... I don't know. I know there's a third of the country that is very supportive of our president, but I just hope that as time goes on, they begin to see that he's not honest. He's not going to do anything but bad things for us, and I hope that they, you know, don't support him so much. I hope they will gradually realize what they have supported. Bad for our country.
William Daniels, Bonnie Bartlett, it is an absolute delight for us to talk with both of you. Thank you so much for making time for us.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
So much fun with that. It's Bonnie Bartlett and William Daniels here as we wrap up the Best of Downtown on this Sunday morning. Thanks to the two of them for being with us, author Elizabeth Strout and actress Karen Allen as well. Coming up tomorrow on the program, lots of good stuff. Charlotte Wilder of SB Nation spent a week up in Maine at the lobster boat races off Jonesport. Did a wonderful piece on that. We'll talk with her about the experience. Sean McAdam, Boston Sports Journal on the Red Sox. Mike Lowe of the Portland Press Herald after Maine football's second preseason scrimmage tomorrow. And movie reviews with Alan Adams of the Maine Edge. All coming up tomorrow afternoon at 4 o'clock. You have a wonderful rest of your Sunday. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. We'll see you tomorrow afternoon right here on Downtown.